Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, good evening. This is L.A. Steele. And tonight, I'm going to do something a little different. I've been reviewing the last few books, the two books by Barack Obama. And the first was The Dream of My Father, and the second was The Audacity of Hope. I have been troubled, very troubled, by the Obama administration and much of its strangeness, and it's very, very difficult to understand, but it, as far as the person himself, you know, Obama, and not at all aren't complex to some degree, but Obama, probably more than anyone, has captivated the imagination of not just the United States, but the world. And unfortunately, man couldn't live up to his own PR and got a lot of enemies. But I can't quite understand. I have to go back and look at review these books and try to find out more about the man. And I guess what it is that more or less what's the word I'm looking for compels me is the complexity of this character, in the sense that a very, very unusual story. And I was going to just review or read maybe a little bit tonight from his book, The Dreams of My Father, and try to see the character of this guy. And he wrote this book in 1995, and I believe he was in 1995, he was in his 20s. He was 24. And he is 24 years old. And he just became the first black man to be a part of his, to be the first black man in Harvard to be the editor of the Harvard Law Review. And in many ways, that's, of course, it was a major achievement. But, you can't help but understand that he was obviously was kind of fashioned, if you will. And he himself says that he was lucky and privileged in the sense that he had to get into this college and be promoted or pushed forward. But if you look at his background, he has a tremendously different perspective in life than most people, especially at such a young age. And because of that perspective, he was able to propel himself into the political arena and acquire the background and backing, if you will, to become president. And, you know, at 40, I believe 42 years old or so, you know, or 40 years old. And the phenomenon of that is in itself unusual. And I guess what I'm trying to get at, and I'm not clear, this whole issue is not clear for me, because nobody has ever been propelled that far, that fast, with so many obstacles, one being, of course, that he was a black man or an African-American in the United States, when nobody ever thought that would possibly have happened, you know. And the other significant aspect was that that he was also whether he was a media creation or not, he was able to propel the nation into a remarkable sense of optimism, never before seen, really, especially amongst the possibly the liberals. And I guess I can understand in a way why there was so much excitement about him, and that excitement generated from, you know, the left, of course. And I wrote about that at the time. And I was very, very skeptical of Obama. And when his arrival, because there really wasn't anything overwhelmingly different about his rhetoric, you know, except perhaps in the way that he presented it. But his rhetoric was basically rather trite, you know. And that in itself was, I'm trying to look at it for a book that I had. For some reason, I can't seem to locate it now. But, disturbing. But anyway, the overall essence of his early writing was one of sincerity and retrospect and just a rather fascinating guy. And but again, I guess I'm having difficulty trying to reflect on this because it's so such an important character. Such an important and significant person in history, at such a critical moment in time, that it kind of transcends a normal it transcends the normal explanation, if you will, of a historical personality. And in doing that, we have to look more seriously at this person. And we're fortunate in many ways that he was able to have a book that he wrote at such a young age, at 24 years old, and and see the mind, the way the guy was thinking, how he was thinking, and know what the what he was stating. I'm going to shut my window here. It's the window's picking up, if you can hear it in the background. And we are. I think the best way to start is right at chapter one of his book, The Dreams of My Father. Because having been an author, being an author, the way that you start your book is the way that you begin a book is probably the most telltale part of you and definitely the story. So your first, and it's the way that you capture your audience, you know, that first statement. And, you know, the introduction is one thing, but, a lot of people skip the introductions. But in this one, then, chapter one, which is, we look at the first paragraph. And in it, you can capture a young man. And, almost poetic. So, and again, with a strong sense of a strong observer. He was an observer. And he had the memories of these things and the way he expressed it. I think it's important to read it, and I'm going to do that. It starts this way. A few months after my 21st birthday, a stranger called to give me the news. I was living in New York at the time on 94th between 2nd and 1st, part of that unnamed shifting border between East Harlem and the rest of Manhattan. It was an uninviting block, treeless and barren, lined with soot-colored walk-ups and that cast heavy shadows for most of the day. The apartment was small with slanting floors and irregular heat and a buzzer downstairs that didn't work, so that visitors had to call ahead from a payphone at the corner gas station, where a black Doberman, the size of a wolf, paced through the night in vigilant patrol, its jaws clamped around an empty beer bottle. None of this concerned me much, for I didn't get many visitors. I was impatient in those days, busy with work and unrealized plans, and prone to see other people as unnecessary distractions. It wasn't that I didn't appreciate company exactly. I enjoyed exchanging Spanish pleasantries with my mostly Puerto Rican neighbors, and on my way back from classes, I usually stopped to talk to the boys who hung out on the stoop all summer long about the Knicks or the gunshots they heard the night before. When the weather was good, my roommate and I sit out on the fire escape to smoke cigarettes and study the dusk washing blue over the city, or watch white people from the better neighborhoods nearby walk their dogs down our block to let the animals shit on our curbs. "Scoop the poop, you bastards!" My roommate would shout with impressive rage, and would laugh at the faces of both master and beast, grim and unapologetic as they hunkered down to do the deed. I enjoyed such moments, but only in brief. If the talk began to wander or cross the border into familiarity, I would soon find reason to excuse myself. I had grown too comfortable in my solitude, the safest place I knew. This is interesting to the extent, because he, if you recollect, went into a very a state of solitude for quite some time as an academic and student and so on. But but let's go on, because this was a changing point for him. I remember there was an old man living next door who seemed to share my disposition. He lived alone, a gaunt, stooped figure who wore a heavy black overcoat and a misshapen fedora on those rare occasions when he left his apartment. Once in a while, I'd run into him on the way back from the shore. and I would offer to carry his groceries up the long flight of stairs. He would look at me and shrug, and we would begin our ascent, stopping at each landing so that he could catch his breath. When he finally arrived at his apartment, I'd carefully set the bags down on the floor, and he would offer a courtly nod of acknowledgement before shuffling inside and closing the latch. Not a single word would pass between us, and not once did he ever thank me for my efforts. The old man's silence impressed me. I thought him a kindred spirit. Later, my roommate would find him crumpled up on the third floor landing, his eyes wide open, his limbs stiff and curled up like a baby's. A crowd gathered. A few of the women crossed themselves, and the smaller children whispered with excitement. Eventually, the paramedics arrived to take away the body, and the police let themselves into the old man's apartment. It was neat, almost empty, a chair, a desk, a faded portrait of a woman with heavy eyebrows, and a gentle smile set atop the mantelpiece. Somebody opened the refrigerator and found close to $1,000 in small bills rolled up inside wads of old newspaper and carefully arranged behind many mayonnaise pickle jars. The loneliness of the scene affected me, and for the briefest moment I wished that I had learned the old man's name. And almost immediately I regretted my desire, along with its companion grief. I felt as if an understanding had been broken between us, as if in that barren room the old man was whispering an untold story, history, telling me things I preferred not to hear. It must have been a month or so later, on a cold, dreary November morning, the sun faint behind a gauze of clouds, that the other call came. I was in the middle of making myself breakfast with coffee on the stove and two eggs in the skillet when my roommate handed me the phone. The line was thick with static. "Barry, Barry, is this you?" "Yes, who's this?" "Yes, Barry, this is your Aunt Jane in Nairobi. Can you hear me?" "I'm sorry, who did you say you were?" "Aunt Jane, listen, Barry, your father is dead. He is killed in a car accident. Hello, can you hear me? I say your father is dead, Barry. Please call your uncle in Boston and tell him. I can't talk now. Okay, Barry. I will try to call you again." That was all. The line cut off, and I sat down on the couch, smelling eggs burn in the kitchen, staring at cracks in the plaster, trying to measure my loss. At that point, We understand the man, at least the young man, and who was 21 years old. And of course, remember, he was 24 when he wrote this book. But the essence of this man was one of, he preferred to be, he didn't like becoming too close to anyone, which he admitted, even to his roommate or to friends or acquaintances. And he was distant and rather reclusive to that extent. And I find that fascinating. And yet, his relationship with the old man, who he found, was found dead, and he saw him dead in the on the third floor landing, and saw the emptiness of his apartment and the emptiness of his life, and $1,000 in small bills in the refrigerator, perhaps all of his life savings. And at that moment, he broke away from his respect for the man and just kind of pulled away. And, you know, and then you have to rather see that, you know, why he did that. And I believe I can. But then shortly later, about a month month later, he had time to reflect on the loss of the old man. And then he gets a call saying that his father died. Now, his father, who he hadn't seen since he was 2 years old, he really didn't even know who he was, other than through stories his mother told or his grandfather told. And he gets into that in the book. But let me continue, because I think it's quite apparent. At the time of his death, my father remained a myth to me, both more and less than a man. He had left Hawaii back in 1963 when I was only 2 years old, so that as a child I knew him only through the stories that my mother and grandparents told. They all had their favorites, each one seamless, burnished smooth from repeated use. And he goes into a description of his grandfather and his mother's father. And you gotta remember, his mother was white and his father was black. And his grandparents were white and they lived in Hawaii. And he goes on with the description of his mother and father and grandfather and so on, but just to bring the reader closer to what he was thinking. But after a strange story about his father, his mother admitted, he says, "Your father can be a bit domineering." My mother would admit with a hint of a smile, "But it's just that he is basically a very honest person that makes him uncompromising sometimes." She preferred a gentler portrait of my father. She would tell the story of when he arrived to accept his Phi Beta Kappa key in his favorite outfit, jeans and an old knit shirt with a leopard print pattern. Nobody told him it was this big honor, so he walked in and found everyone standing around this elegant room dressed in a tuxedo. And the only time I ever saw him embarrassed. This is a quote from his mother. And he said, and Gramps, suddenly thoughtful, would start nodding to himself and say, "It's a fact, Bar." He would say, "Your dad could handle just about any situation, and that made everybody like him. Remember the time he had to sing at the International Music Festival? He'd agreed to sing some African songs, but when he arrived, it turned out to be this big to-do, and the woman who performed just before him was a semi-professional singer, a Hawaiian gal with a full band to back her up. Anyone else would have stopped right there, you know, and explained that there had been a mistake, but not Barack." His father's name was Barack. "He got up and started singing in front of this big crowd, which is no easy feat. And let me tell you, and he wasn't great, but he was so sure of himself that before you knew it, he was getting as much applause as anybody." My grandfather shake his head and get out of the chair to flip on the TV set. "Now there's something you can learn from your dad," he would tell me, "confidence. Secret to a man's success." And that, you know, these are tidbits, but significant moments of what a young man remembers. And I recall when I was about 24, my grandfather suddenly passed away, and I was very, very close to my grandfather. Loved him dearly, but he was he could be a crotchety old guy, you know, but he was a contractor and builder and self-made and you know, well-to-do. But he only had an eighth grade education. But he was one of the most well-read men I've ever known to this day. And he told me once, I remember when we were sharing I visited him one week, one summer, and had a wonderful visit, actually, and it was the last day, and he died, actually, about 6 months later, after that visit. But he told me a tremendous number of things, and one thing I'll never forget, that he said that, he never wanted to be caught, because he always wanted to know things. He always wanted to understand things. The man was a draftsman. He was an engineer. He was an architect. He was a stonemason. He was a carpenter. There was nothing that he felt he couldn't do, you know, except probably grow taller, because he was only about 5'2". But that never stopped him. But he had confidence. He had so damn much confidence. And that he could, you know, he wasn't a public speaker. He was a humble man, in the sense that he was a modest man. But he was a genius, but one of a genius of his time. He grew up in the 30s, you know, or 30s, or 20s, and 30s, and 40s during the Depression. Raised his family through the Depression. One of the jobs that he had in the Depression was a window dresser for a major department store. And he was the chief window dresser. And many of his designs were actually copied and put in designer magazines and so on. And he was an artist. A draftsman, an artist, an engineer, an architect, and all of these, and he was a hunter and a fisherman and a respecter of nature, a lover of nature, and he was an investor. He was a real estate speculator. He was a, my God, there was nothing that this guy didn't do. But the confidence factor, and I go back to this, is everything. And anything that you do in life is centered around your confidence that you have in yourself. And I'm going to continue on that thought for just a moment, because I think it's so critical, so important, is that how a man like Obama could impress enough people at an early age to put him into positions of authority and power, until he became, by the time he was 40, the most powerful man in the world. And how do you assert yourself, or how do you come to grips with yourself as a man of power, other than have confidence that you can tackle the most difficult job in the world? Because every job that you tackle is the most difficult job in the world at the moment. It's in the most difficult job in your world. And so by transforming that into greater and greater and greater responsibilities, taking on those responsibilities, you can only do that through confidence. And he says, that's how all the stories went. Compact, Apocryphal, apocryphal told in rapid succession in the course of one evening, then packed away for months, sometimes years, in a family memory. And like the few photographs of my father that remained in the house, old black and white studio prints that I might run across while rummaging through the closets in search of Christmas ornaments or an old snorkel set. At the point where my own memories begin, my mother had already begun a courtship with a man who would become her second husband. And I sensed without explanation why the photographs had to be stored away. But once in a while, sitting on the floor in my mother, the smell of dust in the mothballs rising from the crumbling album, I would stare at my father's likeness, dark laughing face, the prominent forehead and thick glasses that made him appear older than his years, and listen as the events of his life tumbled into a single narrative. He was an African, I would learn, a Kenyan of the Luo tribe, born on the shores of Lake Victoria, in a place called Allegro. The village was poor, but his father, my other grandfather, Hussein Aniago Obama, had been a prominent farmer, an elder of the tribe, a medicine man, and healing powers. My father grew up herding his father's goats and attending the local school set up by the British colonial administration, where he had shown great promise. He eventually won a scholarship to study in Nairobi, and then on the eve of Kenyan independence, he had been selected by Kenyan leaders and the American sponsors to attend a university in the United States, joining the first large wave of Africans to be sent forth to master Western technology and bring it back to forge a new, modern Africa. Think for a moment of the responsibility of Obama's father. Amazing. To be selected by, all the leaders of Kenya, of a country, to be one of the first to be sent to a Western university. In 1959, at the age of 23, he arrived at the University of Hawaii as that institution's first African student. He studied econometrics, worked with unsurpassed concentration, and graduated in 3 years at the top of his class. His friends were legion, and he helped organize the International Students Association, of which he became the first president. In a Russian language course, he met an awkward, shy American girl, only 18, and they fell in love. The girl's parents, wary at first, were won over by his charm and intellect, and the young couple married, and she bore them a son, to whom he bequeathed his name. He won another scholarship, this time, to pursue his PhD at Harvard, but not the money to take his new family with him. A separation occurred and he returned to Africa to fulfill his promise to the continent. The mother and child stayed behind, but the bond of love survived the distances. And there the album would close. And I would wander off content, swaddled in a tale that placed me in the center of a vast and orderly universe. Even in the abridged version that my mother and grandparents offered, there were many things I didn't understand. But I rarely asked for the details that might resolve the meaning of PhD or colonialism or locate Allegro on a map. Instead, the path of my father's life occupied the same terrain as a book my mother once bought for me, a book called Origins, a collection of creation tales from around the world, stories of Genesis and the tree where man was born, Prometheus and the gift of fire, the tortoise of Hindu legend that floated in space supporting the weight of the world on its back. Later, when I became more familiar with the narrower path of happiness to be found in television and the movies, I became troubled by questions. What supported the tortoise? Why did an omnipotent God let a snake cause such grief? why didn't my father return? But at the age of 5 or 6, I was satisfied to leave these distant mysteries intact. Each story, self-contained, as true as the next, to be carried off into peaceful dreams. And my father looked nothing like the people around me. He was black as pitch, my mother white as milk, barely registered in my mind. In fact, I can recall only one story that dealt explicitly with the subject of race as I got older. It would be repeated more often, as if it captured the essence of the mortality tale that my father's life had become. And according to the story, after long hours of study, my father had joined my grandfather and several other friends at a local Waikiki bar. Everyone was in a festive mood, eating and drinking to the sounds of slack key guitar, when a white man abruptly announced to the bartender loudly enough for everyone to hear that he shouldn't have to drink good liquor next to a nigger. The room fell quiet and people turned to my father expecting a fight. Instead, my father stood up, walked over to the man, smiled, and proceeded to lecture him about the folly of bigotry, the promise of the American dream, and the universal rights of man. This fella felt so bad, when Barack was finished, Gramps would say, that he reached on into his pocket and gave Barack $100, $100 on the spot, paid for all our drinks and poo-poos for the rest of the night, and your dad's rent for the rest of the month. By the time I was a teenager, I'd grown skeptical of this story's veracity, and I'd set it aside with the rest, until I received a phone call many years later from a Japanese-American man who said he had been my father's classmate in Hawaii and now taught at the Midwestern University. He was very gracious, a bit embarrassed by his own impulsiveness. And he explained that he had seen an interview of me in his local paper and that the sight of my father's name had brought back a rush of memories. Then, during the course of our conversation, he repeated the same story that my grandfather had told about the white man who had tried to purchase my father's forgiveness. I'll never forget that, the man said to me over the phone. And in his voice, I heard the same note that I heard from Gramps so many years before. That note of disbelief and hope. let me continue, but I wanted to make note of the tone of his writing, the essence of his beliefs, the and how at the age of 40 or so, as whatever he was when he became president, that he was able to carry that tremendous weight, that tremendous responsibility, even though he was criticized greatly, and he's still extremely criticized. And you have to understand if it's because of his blackness or is because of his arrogance or his vanity, or they're all there, no question about it. But at the same time, we all have those foibles. And I write in, I wrote in my book, which I would like to finish with tonight, an essay that a liberal's victory of faith against fear. And let me continue this just briefly. There's a few more paragraphs I'd like to read in this first chapter. After it says he years before that noted disbelief and hope, but misignation. The word is humpbacked, ugly, pretending a monstrous outcome, like antebellum or octoroon. It evokes images of another era, a distant world of horsewhips and flames, dead magnolias and crumbling porticos. And yet it wasn't until 1967, the year I celebrated my 16th birthday, and Jimi Hendrix performed at Monterey, 3 years after Dr. King received the Nobel Prize, a year when America had already begun to weary of black demands for equality. The problem of discrimination presumably solved, that the Supreme Court of the United States would get around to telling the state of Virginia that its ban on interracial marriages violated the Constitution. In 1960, the year that my parents were married, miscegenation, miscegenation, is the way that word is spelled, still described a felony in over half the states in the Union. In many parts of the South, my father could have been strung up from a tree for merely looking at my mother the wrong way. And in most sophisticated of northern cities, the hostile stares, the whispers, the might have driven a woman in my mother's predicament into a black alley abortion, or at the very least to a distant convent that could arrange for adoption. Their very image together would have been considered lurid and perverse, a handy retort to the handful of soft-headed liberals who supported a civil rights agenda. Sure, but would you let your daughter marry one? The fact that my grandparents had answered yes to this question, no matter how grudgingly, remains an enduring puzzle to me. There was nothing in their background to predict such a response. No New England transcendentalists or wide-eyed socialists in their family tree. True, Kansas was fought on the Union side of the Civil War. Gramps liked to remind me that various strands of the family contained ardent abolitionists. It asked Toot would turn her head in profile to show off her beaked nose, which with a pair of jet black eyes was often as proof of Cherokee blood. That was her mother, his grandmother, who was named Toot, nickname. is a Cherokee. But an old sepia-toned photograph on the bookshelf soft, or rather spoke most eloquently of their roots. It showed Toot's grandparents of Scottish and English stock standing in front of a ramshackle homestead, unsmiling and dressed in coarse wool, their eyes squinting at the sun-baked flinty life that stretched out before them. Theirs were the faces of American Gothic, the WASP bloodline poorer cousins, and in their eyes one could see truths that I would have to learn later as facts. Kansas had entered the Union free only after a violent precursor to the Civil War, and the battle in which John Brown's sword tasted first blood, that while one of my great-great-grandfathers, Christopher Columbus Clark, had been a decorated Union soldier, his wife's mother was rumored to have been a second cousin of Jefferson Davis, president of the Confederacy, that although another distant ancestor had indeed been a full-blooded Cherokee. Such lineage was a source of considerable shame to Toot's mother, who blanched whenever someone mentioned the subject and hoped to carry the secret to her grave. That was the world in which my grandparents had been raised. The Dab Smack, landlocked center of the country, a place where decency, endurance, and pioneer spirit were joined at the hip with conformity and suspicion and the potential for unblinking cruelty. They had grown up less than 20 miles away from each other, my grandmother in Augusta, my grandfather in El Dorado, towns too small to warrant Bullface on a map, and the childhoods they like to recall for my benefit portrayed small-town, Depression-era America in all its innocent glory. 4th of July parades and the picture shows on the side of barns, fireflies in a jar, and the taste of vine-ripe tomatoes, sweet as apples, dust storms and hailstorms in classrooms filled with the farm boys who got sewn into their woolen underwear at the beginning of winter and stank like pigs as the month wore on. but I love this, and I truly, truly enjoy reading this book. And there, it's very insightful, and just as he is. And I, like I said, I've had difficulty with his. Presidency thus far, but I think many of his advisors have been giving him bad advice, and I think, and I'm hoping that in some way he will become a greater man and we may see that in the near future, as his advisors change. And that happens every 2 years. It always seems to happen where advisors change and presidents take on President's Day. And I wanted to read this, if I can find it. I was very cynical in this about the elections, and I didn't believe we really truly had a strong choice. But Barack was seriously one of the only choices. And for that, I guess that's why we have him. But I'd like to. I have this essay in the metaphysical part of my book. Because it is so, it was total faith as far as my my vote for Obama. And I'm going to read it now. It's called A Liberal's Victory of Faith Against Fear. I wrote this the day after the election, November 5th, poll 2008. I'm very happy today. It is a great day. One of those days that I feel a part of creating a new American and world history. I know many people who are not very happy today because Barack Obama won the presidency last night. But that isn't my problem today. Today I feel good. Today I feel hopeful, optimistic, and every other positive adjective that describes happiness. I am happy because the presidential race is over. I am happy because I feel a great justice has been served by the American people. I feel happy because the intent of my vote for Barack Obama was honest, undiluted, and completely emotionally inspired. I, like 64% of voting Americans, made a choice yesterday for the virtue of the United States, or rather the future of the United States. My vote was based on faith that Barack Obama should win the presidency. I was becoming a very cynical radio talk show host who had little faith in the American election process and was losing faith in my fellow citizens that were not seeing what was happening to their country. But last night's confirmation of Barack Obama's victory gave me a jolt of hope, inspiration, and pride like I had never received before from casting my vote in this great republic. Faith is a great power, a great promise, a great inspiration. I believe that Americans have faith in a great future. I believe we can repair the horrible damage that has caused by 8 years of the worst leadership the country has ever had to bear. I believe we can repair our national reputation around the world. I believe we will rid our country of all homelessness and despair. I believe we will withdraw our military from Iraq and Afghanistan. I believe we will restore our national economy to the strongest in the world. I believe we will cull the criminal and cowardly elements from our government and bring all traitors and criminals to justice. I believe we will repair the division of the right and left factions in this country. I believe we will see a renaissance of liberalism in this country that will inspire American ingenuity, industry, and art to the heights never before imagined by mankind. Fear motivated the McCain voters. The fear of losing their power, fear of responsibility, fear of shedding their ignorance, fear of ridding their demons of hatred and bigotry, fears of sharing their nation's wealth with their fellow Americans, fear of minority reprisals, fear of their own criminal acts and intentions being exposed, fear of their traditions of ignorance and inferiority being changed to enlightenment and great self-esteem, fear of being wrong, fear of having faith in the best of mankind, fear of having faith in God and America, fear of no longer having fear. The election of Barack Obama to the presidency of the United States proved to me that all is and will be well with the country. It proved to me that the strength and determination of liberal Americans are now unified and will soon be solidified into the greatest and most determined people on the planet, ready to forge ahead in the direction of a remarkable and bountiful future, regardless of who their president is. But as my readers know by now, I am a hopeful idealist. So, that's my reason for voting for Obama, basically. And and others. And if you read my book, Naked at the Mic, The Survival of a Liberal in Time of Peril, and you can get that at Amazon.com. I think you'll be surprised. And I kept it quite honest because I spoke from the heart on that. That's why I respect this book that Obama wrote, because I believe he, being his first book, he wrote from the heart. His second book was a little more lofty, a little more wordy, a little more mature, and, well, much more mature, The Audacity of Hope. But that was written by a man who aspired to be president of the United States. Whereas this was written by a man who was discovering himself, coming to terms with who he was, and who his father was, and who his mother was, and who his ancestry was, and how he fit in this world, and how he developed his views and his ideals, and how he developed 160 IQ, you know, and why he's able to grasp a broader understanding of the global situation, which is what we need today. Because to be so myopic as John McCain or God knows who else, you can't be. And to have that Muslim influence as well as the Christian influence, as well as the Native American influence, as well as all of these built into one man, it's remarkable. And it gives us it gives Obama a much broader view. Look, and again, like I say, you can see he's an observer, he's a listener, he's a watcher. And after everything is done, he tries to evaluate best he can. I, for one, feel he should be much more firm in his approach. But again, I'm not there where he is, and having to lord over so many faults and so many bigots and so many radicals and so many views. So, you know, all I can do is say, hey, Obama, good luck. And I'll still criticize you when I think I'm wrong, but, you know, I respect your work. I respect your writing. I respect where you came from. Except for one day. He talks about the bad news era hit my mother the hardest. She was 11 or 12 at this time, an only child just growing out of a bad case of asthma. The illness, along with the numerous moves, had made her something of a loner, cheerful and easily tempered, but prone to bury her head in a book or wander off on solitary walks. And Toot, which was his grandmother, began to worry that his latest move had only made her daughter eccentricities more pronounced. My mother made new friends in her new school, and she was teased mercilessly for her name, Stanley Ann, one of Graham's less judicious ideas. He had wanted a son. And Stanley Steamer, they called her Stan the Man. When Toot got home from work, she would usually find my mother alone in the front yard, swinging her legs on the porch or lying in the grass, pulled into some solitary world of her own. Except for one day. There was that one hot, windless day when Toot came home to find a crowd of children gathered around the picket fence that surrounded their house. As Toot grew closer, she could make out the sounds of mirthless laughter, the contortions of rage and disgust in the children's faces. The children were chanting in a high-pitched, alternating rhythm, "Nigger lover, dirty Yankee, nigger lover." And the children scattered, and they saw Toot, but not one but not before one of the boys had sent the stone in his hand sailing over the fence. Tootsie's followed the stone's trajectory as it came to rest at the foot of a tree, and there she saw the cause of all the excitement. My mother and a black girl of about the same age lying side by side on their stomachs in the grass, their skirts gathered up above their knees, their toes dug into the ground, their heads propped up on their hands in front of ones of my mother's books. From a distance, the two girls seemed perfectly serene beneath this leafy shade. It was only when Toot opened the gate that she realized the black girl was shaking and my mother's eyes shone with tears, and the girls remained motionless, paralyzed with fear, until Toot finally leaned down and put her hand on both their heads. And she said, "If you two are going to play," she said, "then for goodness sakes, go on inside. Come on, both of you." She picked up my mother and reached for the other girl's hand, but before she could say anything more, the girl was in a full sprint, her long legs like a whippet's, as she vanished down the street. And I'm going to end tonight with that. And, let me finish this paragraph. Rance was beside himself when he heard what had happened. He interrogated my mother, wrote down names. The next day he took the morning off from work to visit the school principal. He personally called the parents of some of the offending children to give them a piece of his mind. And from every adult that he spoke to, he received the same response. "You best talk to your daughter, Mr. Dunham. White girls don't play with colors in this town." Yeah. So, that's what his mother went through. His father. His sister. And his grandmother. And I guess from that perspective, and I've seen racial hatred as well, and it's cruel and it's bitter and it's harsh and it's horrid, lethal, and I have to respect what he, Obama, went through. As I respect what any man or woman or child goes through when confronted by bigotry and hatred, being shouted at and called names. It's difficult. So the size of the man, and I say the size, I think he should be respected. He's got a big task ahead of him. And he was sweeping up from the most horrid administration ever for 8 years of hell. And we knew it would take at least 2 years to clean up this mess, maybe three. But, you know, things were worse than ever. And there's a lot of pressure on Mr. Obama, and I wish him the best. That's all we got, and I hope we can pull this off. So anyway, I want to thank you for listening to the show tonight, and please join us tomorrow when we have George Dixon. We'll be talking about the Mayan calendar and timeline, and the energies that we're going through now, and we'll be discussing other aspects of that. So again, tomorrow night, 8 o'clock, right here, Lila and George Dixon will be with us, with me, and hope that you join us. And hope you have a pleasant evening, and good night.